Hello and welcome to this week's Next Sense Institute podcast. My name's Trudy Smith. I'm the Manager of Continuing Professional Education at Next Sense Institute and your podcast host for today. We are continuing our discussions around advocacy and we have an old friend to the podcast joining us today. Elise Lonsdale is a very old friend and really lovely to have them with us again. Elise, if you could introduce yourself to anyone who hasn't heard one of your previous podcasts with us.
Thank you very much, Trudy. It's lovely to be back for the third time. So, and I believe there was a bit of a recess last year, so it's good to see the podcast return to the podcast waves, so to speak. I am vision impaired. I've got 10% vision. I have worked for many of the blindness organisations, the Visibility in Western Australia, Blind and Low Vision in New Zealand, and for a little while, Vision Australia for only a short tenure at in Melbourne when I returned from living in New Zealand. For the last almost 5 years now, I've had a job with the Statewide Vision Resource Centre, who I know Next Sense has a relationship with, working with blind and low vision children in the support skills program. The same year I started with the SVRC was also the same year I commenced Data Australasia, which is a business that offers support for people on the NDIS, for people who are blind and have low vision. And that support is training, technology, access technology, of course. So all the JAWS users, NVDA users, ZoomText users, the Apple VoiceOver users, Apple Watch and Apple iPhone and all the good stuff, Braille displays, Braille note takers, we're happy to talk to you. And that's my business. And it's been very successful and the ride has been a lot of fun.
And we have talked about that work in our previous podcast. So I do encourage people to follow up and have a listen to those too. But for today, we're talking about advocacy, Elise. And I wonder if you could share some of your experiences as an advocate, firstly for yourself.
Thank you. Myself, I'm vision impaired and I'm also transgender. I am a Toastmaster as well. I've resumed doing that since my last podcast with you guys. Mm-hmm. And it's been a lot of fun. Some clubs are really, really on top of things when it comes to inclusion. Others are a little different. I'm privileged to be a member of the Wandon Toastmasters Club, and they have actually, without doing too much advocating for myself, welcomed me with open arms. And they've actually invited me to be, even despite my low vision, they've actually invited me to be their new video, I guess I'll do a little bit of Zoom mastering, but I know there's another lady doing that, their video and recording and posting onto social media, the speeches mm-hmm. and evaluations that are done. So I didn't have to advocate for myself so much there, but there have been other instances where I've had to advocate for myself when it comes to previously getting jobs. And basically, I guess sometimes in being low vision, it's difficult because sometimes it's easy to say you're blind and that's the end of it. The conversation stops. Mm-hmm. But when you've got low vision, then you get, what can you see? And you get that, how far can you see? And I go, I don't really know. about 1/10 of what you can see is often what I tell people. 660 vision is what I have. And it is just that, pretty much 1/10 of what a sighted person would see. So imagine looking at a sign and you can read something or see something at 60 meters. I would have to be within 6 meters to read the same or to enjoy the same effect. But that's not all. It gets even harder. I've got 30% or less than 30% field of vision. So in actual fact, just getting me closer to the object doesn't necessarily mean to say I'm going to have the same experience. So it can get confusing. And I've found there's many, many cases over the years I've had to have that conversation with people, but I've also found sometimes I've got to make it so that they can understand it. Yep. Especially if you're going for a job and you don't want this low vision blind caper to get in the way of that. And you want to be able to put together a front that can, or at least a statement, although not that I've had to go for a job in open employment for quite some time, because the last number of jobs I've had over the last 10 years have been within the blindness organisation, starting with, you know, Visibility in Western Australia. So I haven't had to have that particular conversation, but when I was going for open employment many years ago in the non-blindness general community, I found I had to advocate harder, obviously, because you're dealing with people who don't understand it. And now these days, they're worried about occupational health and safety. So there's no way I'd ever get another job in a factory anymore, which doesn't bother me to a great extent, to be honest.
Yeah.
you know, I made the move into computers from a vocational point of view way back in the early 90s.
Sure.
But, you know, these days you've got OH&S and people worry about that sort of stuff. Some things are fine to worry about. Other things, they're probably just being a bit too cautious, or mm-hmm. sadly they can use it as an excuse not to employ you.
Yeah.
So you've really got to be on top of it.
Yeah, and I can imagine that, as you say, it could be a potential minefield just even bringing up vision
loss.
It's
hard to know how to bring it up and when to bring it up, isn't it?
Yeah, it would be, I suspect. And I guess it really does come down to, does that influence your ability to do the job itself that they're hiring for?
Well, this is just it. And that's what I used to say when I was going for help desk roles in the late 90s. I was saying to them, look, this doesn't affect my ability to do that job. I have to do the job differently. I have to use a screen reader, which means I can put that into the headphones. So it won't bother the callers who are calling in. It means I can access, as long as the CRM or whatever they're using at the time is accessible, which some were, some had various degrees of accessibility. It means I can still get to the same place, but I just take a different route.
Sure. And do you find, Elise, that when you have that conversation and you mm-hmm. say, but here's my solution, like I'll use the screen reader through headphones, which won't affect, does that change the nature of the conversation?
It seemed to back then, and it still seems to now. Like if you, for example, get a Toastmaster who doesn't understand how I can access the material, well, the material is a bit dicey because they've built the thing on Flash. But if you get a club that's inclusive, you can get somebody to help you do things. But what you say is, you definitely say that, and I've said that in many speeches, it doesn't affect my ability to do what I have to do, therefore I'm going to do it. I just have to find a different way of doing it.
Sure.
And that really helps the non-vision impaired person.
Yep.
You've got to remember this world is not built for vision impaired people. It simply isn't. It's not built for many disabled people.
I think I would want to hire somebody who's more creative about finding solutions, which you're suggesting is definitely somebody who has low vision.
I believe I am, and I've even shocked some of the blindness organisations I've worked for because I've come up with some pretty strange way out there ways of skinning cats, of conquering that mountain. And I do think, you know, I love these people who say, oh, well, you've got to be able to think outside the square. And when you do, they don't like it when you stick your head above the parapet. But I do. I don't let that scare me. And I do think outside the box. And I do come up with some pretty crazy ways of getting things done because that's half the fun of it.
Absolutely. And that doesn't surprise me the slightest, given how well I know you, Elise.
I know.
I'm curious about in terms of the wider community and examples of advocacy, particularly in the work you do now for the blind and low vision community.
Yep. Yeah, well, every time I write an NDIS report on my ghostwriter, Kylie, who comes in and lends a hand to do that because I get very busy, and she can often think more bureaucratically than I do. I'm the world's biggest pragmatist. Mm-hmm. So every time we write one of these, we're actually advocating for our client because you're dealing with bureaucrats who have probably even never met a blind person, much less know what a refreshable braille display is or a refreshable braille note taker is. And then you've got to explain the difference between the two. And we do an assessment or we work with the client to decide what is the most appropriate for the client based on what they've used in the past, what they would like to use, what they've actually trialed. If they've had a trial, sometimes they don't, but most of them do. Mm-hmm. And particularly with the Braillies, they've grown up with Braille and they've learnt it at school, whether it be, you know, through Nabathong in Queensland or back in the day or you know, North Rocks and St. Lucy's, St. Edmunds in Sydney, RVIB as it was back in the day here in Victoria and the other blindness organisations around the country that have, they just know Braille and they're just so good at doing Braille. Braille is to to blind people what print is to a sighted person. And we put that, we actually make that statement in our reports because it's a fact of life. So we have to, and obviously that's, sometimes that's the clincher, because people start thinking, the sighted person starts thinking, well, what happens if I couldn't write a note? Or what happens if I couldn't see a screen to type a letter? Or if I couldn't see the keyboard and so on and so forth. We're very big on keyboarding skills here at Data Australasia, for obvious reasons. Now, I probably don't have to explain that to you, and I probably don't have to explain that to many of the people in the audience, but for those, for the uninitiated, the keyboarding skill is paramount. It's what I call a foundation skill. And if we're trying to, say, advocate for more hours in an upcoming renewal of an NDIS plan, we'll often discuss that in these letters of recommendations as well, because the sighted person might be the hunt and peck type person who just looks at two or three keys. And without the sight, and I've met many people who have been in the unfortunate situation where that's what they were until their sight started to decline, and then all of a sudden that hunting and pecking method won't work for them. And, you know, large print keyboards only have a limited life if you've got a degenerative condition. I'm not a big advocate for them because you're only really staving off the inevitable. If the sight gets to a point where it's not usable, then that sight can actually, or that lack of, or that low vision can actually turn out to be your enemy. Yep. So you really want people to have that experience in the keyboarding. And it's done with the old traditional drills. And we've got a self-paced online and learning program through the Ed Club, which is Typing Club. That was an idea I pinched from Statewide Vision Resource Centre. But it works well for both the adult NDIS participants that I look after and the students that we look after at Statewide. It works well in both.
Yep.
Sure. Yeah, so basically that's pretty much the technology is paramount, and people often say, well, you know, why do you need this technology? Well, they need it because it talks. They need it because it's got a screen magnifier if we're working in the low vision space, because there are plenty of people out there who need to buy Zoom Text or something. And if their vision isn't going to decline, then if they're happy enough to use that, we work with people with the static vision as well. But because a new piece of technology has become available, like a new video magnifier, for example, or some updated version to Zoom Text, et cetera, there are options that should be considered just as much as options are for totally blind people and people who may not wish to use what remaining vision they have.
Yeah, sure. I wonder, Elise, when you write those NDIS reports, obviously the client is reading them as well as NDIS planner. Do you hear yourself back to you? Do you hear your clients using the language that you're using to then advocate for themselves into the future?
Yes, actually, it's a very good point. I hadn't really considered it, but yes, I do hear them using that language back. So they're talking to me about that language. Now, obviously, I'm not present at their NDIS plan reviews, but I do hear them walk the talk. I do hear them adopt by osmosis the jargon, so to speak, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You're giving them the language to then...
The language to use, yes, because it does have, you know, blindom does have its own language. And, you know, and that carries through to the usage of, say, the computers, for example. You know, Windows or Mac OS or any graphical user interface has its own lingo, so to speak, and that's, you know, what to do if you come across a checkbox, or what to do if you come across a drop-down list, or how to use a pull-down menu, or how to use a ribbon menu. Yeah. What is a dialogue box, and what are the components of a dialogue box? And we can teach them, because they need to have that language, not just so they can tell other people about it. They need to actually have that language so they themselves can understand what it is that they are doing. So when they come across those elements in day-to-day work, they can actually make sense of it all.
Yep. No, absolutely. It's important. But I wonder for you personally, Elise, why is the work of advocacy so important to you?
Well, like I said before, I think, Trudy, the world is not built for blind people. It is not built for vision impaired people, so we have to advocate. And sometimes I myself get frustrated sometimes and go, well, you know, why do we have to keep the fight up? You know, it's almost like a cat and mouse game, because, you know, you advocate for something and it happens for a while, then it gets changed, modified, rebuilt and breaks. You know, a piece of software might break, for example, because it's been updated, because they've got new people in and the accessibility goes west. Even though, you know, building a piece of software and or a website, even putting accessibility through it, it's actually one of the easiest things to do. But in the broader scope of things, the reason it is important is because we have audible traffic signals around Australia. No one cares about them now. They just happen. You know, I remember seeing them for the first time in the 1970s up at the Burwood Blind School, in RVIB school. They put them in there when they ran the tram line through there. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this is awesome. Back in those days, they ticked. Yep. But that was a new concept. I used to have to look for the red or the green light. My mother had to as well. And that's how I was taught when I was very young, how to cross a road. But now we don't have to worry so much. Now the things vibrate, so you can hold the, you know, the little arrow on the button and feel it if you can't hear it. So if you're hearing impaired, if it's too quiet, you can touch it. And they're commonplace. It's amazing. And people don't think about it, but somebody before me came along and advocated for that. It was probably BCA. Advocated for that.
So just for anyone listening, BCA is a Blind Citizens Australia.
Exactly. Yes, Blind Citizens Australia. Careful of the jargon. actually, I think it was, come to think of it, but we've got them all over Australia and New Zealand, and no one bats an eyelid, where it's been somewhat controversial in the United States over the years. So, you know, Blind Citizens Australia or whoever to thank for that. In some places in the inner city of Melbourne, and particularly near where you might find premises of Vision Australia and like organisations, you've got yellow lines on the road to mark up where the space is to walk. Mm-hmm. So if you've got low vision or if you're new to low vision, you have the ability to walk straight across the road if you're using your vision. I'm not sure whether they've got those in Sydney or not, Trudy, but I saw some recently in South Melbourne. So wherever Vision Australia pops up, if they've got a new premises, it tends to just happen here. Sadly, in New Zealand, out the front of the blind organisation I worked for there, I used to call it the Walding Street Speedway because obviously not as much advocacy had been done, or the advocacy that had happened didn't work with the Palmerston North City Council. So you've got a blindness organisation on a non-controlled intersection, and you've got to walk a block in different directions to cross the road safely or take your life in your hands. That's sure. Not cool.
No.
Especially out the front of a blindness organisation. Whereas in Australia, as I said to them at the time, this just happens back home because somebody before us has come along and advocated for it. So it is very important. And even, you know, this is why we have wheelchair ramps, because yes, somebody before us has advocated for that. This is why we have pram ramps, because it's great for wheelchairs, of course, but it's also rather cool for mothers with prams. They get to enjoy the benefit too. So some of these accessibility options that are around because of people advocating actually do help the broader community.
And I think that's what leads to longevity. You know, a piece of trivia for you, the Billie Eilish song Bad Guys, the beat in that is actually the walking sound of crossing the road.
Oh, is it? Haven't realised.
Yeah, so it's gone mainstream now.
Oh, very good. Excellent.
American chat show, so maybe that will lead to it. But it sounds like every single thing that you do is advocacy, Elise. And I wonder for other people who are listening to this thinking, you know, I feel like I could make a contribution to advocacy to the community. What advice do you have for those people?
Get in touch, I guess, with your local government or council. There are disability advocacy groups or disability advisory groups run by different local governments. There's one down in Knox, not far from me. I don't know a great deal about it. I know people who work on it, but I believe they're a good option. If you're interested, get involved. But also when you're involved, listen to what the people with a disability say. We often see sometimes people with the best of intentions. Mm-hmm. I know what's best, and I once knew a person in a wheelchair. Yeah, great. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now you're dealing with deaf-blind people. Oh, now you're dealing with just partially blind people. The paradigm's different. There's not one size that fits all, and it is really good to listen. and to ask questions. And don't be afraid to ask, because if you do not ask, you do not learn.
Sure. And to be honest, Lilies, every time I talk to you, I feel like I learn something. And so, as always, such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much again for taking time to talk to me and sharing your ideas today.
It's a pleasure to be back on here. Thank you, Trudy.
Thanks, Elise. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and we will look forward to talking with you again next week.